Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for coming. My name's Ben. I won't take too much of your time. And just before we get going, I did want to do an acknowledgement of country. I did want to acknowledge the Darug people, the elders past, present and future. I think it's as people that are interested in media, I think we should always remember that symbols are important. And I think something like an acknowledgement of country is very important. And I think it should always be said as well that this land has never been ceded. But that said, it is my great pleasure to introduce Danya Braunstein, who will be our guest tonight, talking to us about, I've forgotten what the title of your talk is, my sincere apologies, click on the tab and all will be revealed, Intersections of Media Effects Research. So I'm really looking forward to this, as I'm sure everyone is, now that we've fought our way through the horrors of Macquarie to find where the place is. And just a few words about Danya. Danya is, like a few of us here, a PhD student. She's here at Macquarie. She did her undergrad at Sydney, so yay! She's in the psychology department here doing her PhD. She's got an MA from Fielding Graduate University, is that correct? Oh, there you go. And as I mentioned, she did her undergrad at Sydney Uni. She's a registered psychologist, researcher, and media consultant. You'll have to tell us about that. What does a media consultant mean? I've always had that question in my mind. So in addition to working in private practice, Danya's a tutor and a former associate lecturer here, where she taught and supervised research in the Master of Social Health and Counselling program. And so that's kind of it from me. Could we please welcome Danya?
Ben, and thank you everybody else for coming and for your patience in bearing with us during our technical difficulties. So I've had some interesting experiences. Before I go on to talk about my talk, I just also want to acknowledge the various academics here at Macquarie who have helped me with my PhD research, Simon Bogue and Wayne Warburton in the Department of Psychology, and also help from Dr. Anthony Lambert in the Department of Media. And also with thanks to Chanel, who is here supporting me and will speak more later herself. So as part of that great introduction, I've had an interesting journey so far. So this was me. I'm on the far right here. On set in 2007, and you might be thinking, what's The Biggest Loser got to do with what I'm talking about today? Well, hopefully by the end of my presentation you'll have a clearer understanding of how I went from being an associate producer on a reality television program to working as a psychologist and a doctoral researcher. So as Ben introduced, I do work as a psychologist in my private practice. I see clients there on occasion, and I also work with provisional psychologists, supervising and training them to become fully registered allied health professionals. So that intersects with my work in the department, teaching at the undergraduate and postgraduate levels, and also in my doctoral research, where I'm interested in personality psychology and in particular the influence of media on personality. So some of the things that I've learned over this time is all of these various experiences have led me to kind of wonder, well, what is the influence on media on a person? Yeah, and if I suggested to you that who you are today is a product of the media that you've consumed over the course of your life, your first reaction is possibly, maybe, yeah, also maybe not, yeah. It's a little bit of a hard sell for some people to think that the person that they are has been caused by media. And part of the reason of that is a hypothesis that was actually developed in 1983 called the third person effect. So people have a tendency to agree that other people get influenced by things, but not necessarily themselves, yeah. We like to think of ourselves as less persuaded, less influenced by forces, that we make our own choices and decisions. So this hypothesis was not originally developed in reference to media. It's a communication theory, but it now gets used very readily to explain the effect of mass-mediated communications on individuals. So, for example, in terms of the controversy around media violence, people have a tendency to say, yeah, I play violent video games, but I don't get affected by it. Yeah, maybe other people do, but not me. Yeah. So when you kind of question, okay, does media really affect us? And if you're thinking about socially responsible media practice, it's an important question, because whether or not you actually take into consideration what the research is a product of whether or not you agree that the media does influence people. So an example of one of those conversations is shown here, and I realise the irony of showing you a drama series which represents the production of a reality television series to explain to you an actual conversation that happens in reality about whether or not media affects people. Let's have a look. Okay. So here's an example of the kind of attitudes that we come across when people are talking about media effects, right? Yeah. One person says, well, don't you know that everything we show people is important, that it influences them? And yet the other people say, well, so what? Yeah. So I guess my question is, well, if we acknowledge that the research shows that there are harmful effects from media, what are the barriers to disrupting that? Does anybody have any ideas in terms of getting media producers to change the content of their media, or in terms of the audiences receiving the message? Yeah?
Yeah, so something that comes up in my research a lot is the value of learning media literacy, being able to critically appraise what's in front of you on a screen or in a book.
Yeah.
As opposed to just taking the message in unprompted.
Yeah, fabulous. So maybe one of the barriers is that people don't have that skill of media literacy enough as an audience to be able to critically appraise the message that they're receiving. Yeah, absolutely.
As far as the production side goes, I mean, it's that truism, right? Stupidity cells or sex cells, right? So that would be a barrier if you can get away with showing the lowest common denominator material for the exact reason you just outlined, that we aren't media savvy as a general audience.
Mm.
There is no reason for change.
Yeah. And that's the problem, you know, when you look at productions, Quinn here is saying, well, I don't care because this show rates.
Yeah.
And if the show rates, the advertisers get on board, there's money, the network's happy, the audience is happy, the audience comes and watches the show. So why would we do anything that's socially responsible? Because what we're doing works. Yeah? So that's a barrier. There's an economic incentive to continue to do what promotes potentially harmful effects. And for the audiences themselves, they might enjoy it, yeah? And so, you know, they want to keep watching the shows that they watch, or, you know, the films that they like, regardless of whether they want to take into consideration that it might harm them or harm other people, yeah? So again, coming back to that third-person effect, quite often people will go and see something saying, but I like it, but yeah, probably, you know, children shouldn't be watching it because it's probably not good for them, yeah? But by endorsing it themselves, they go and buy tickets, or, you know, contribute to the rating that makes something popular and then makes other people more likely to also go and see it. Yep, popularity effect. So what we do know about media effects research, and this has been going on for almost as long as we've had television, really, at least, well, I say 50 years, but that's me being out of date. It's probably closer to 70 or 80 years that this research has been being conducted. And it's probably nothing new. If you're familiar with media theory at all, you've come across instances of media effects. A lot of them, the explanation for the effects come back to social learning theory. So in 1961, Albert Bandura performed this experiment, which was a Bobo doll, got blown up in a laboratory situation. An adult went in there and modelled aggressive behaviour towards the Bobo doll, and then they observed that the children followed the same behaviour. They imitated the behaviour. And so this is an example of modelling which is one of the main theoretical bases of media effects, that what we see on the screen, this isn't a media theory, this is just a social learning theory, but it gets applied to media in the sense that what we see on the screen can be an example by which we learn and we understand that behaviour and we're more likely to reproduce the similar behaviours. These various media effects that are quite commonly cited, quite commonly known about what is represented in the media narratives that our audiences are consuming. And there's more significant references that I could reference there. I'm just pointing out that all of these come from the two handbooks that I reference at the end, just to kind of keep all of the references together. So they're certainly not the seminal works that explain these media effects, but they give quite good overviews if you're interested. So we know that there's aggression responses. We know that people have expectations about what gender might be appropriate for men or for women based on what they see represented. Women typically very underrepresented in media, especially in occupational roles. Yeah, women tend to be more represented as mothers, housewives. Men tend to be represented in privileged roles such as doctors, lawyers, so on. Over-sexualized adult relationship has effect on young people's relationships, resulting in teen pregnancy and other early sexualization. And then all of the issues with representing of minority groups, including race, colour, language, lack of diversity on the screen, and also lack of other areas of diversity such as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, disability. The list is endless of the kinds of minority groups that are not represented well on screen or are stereotypically represented on the screen. So thinking about gender relations, because that's where we tend to look a lot, there's a lot of research looking at gender relations. And I wanted to show you an example of something, you know, so this research on gender representations on the screen has been going on for decades, and yet things don't seem to be changing particularly well. So this is a clip that came out in 2017. I only saw it last year, and it still bothers me today, to be honest. So I want you to have a look at this and tell me what you think the problem with this scene might be. Okay. So... is anybody able to identify the problem that I have with that scene? Amongst many, possibly, but yeah.
Well, comment you're not supposed to ask for anything like that. This was made last year.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And why is it a problem? Just to be explicit about it. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously this happened, you know, this film was made a couple of years ago. But, you know, everything that we're talking about in the media at the moment with Me Too and Time's Up and people talking about how important it is, you know, for women to be able to have consent, to not be sexually harassed, yeah, the high incidence of social, this social issue of women being considered as not needing to give consent. And this sends a subtle message that that's the way it should be, yeah? That if you ask for consent, you're doing the wrong thing, yeah? So the adults are all having this conversation about Me Too and, you know, let's put a stop to this kind of sexual harassment. And then you get subtle messages like this that basically say to young people, because this is a film that young people are going to be watching. I don't know why I was watching it, to be honest, but it's you know, it's the themes are about, you know, killing people and young relationships and... you know, it's marketed towards youth. And it's sending this subtle message that you don't need consent. And you notice she tells him, don't ask, but still never actually gives consent. Yeah, she never actually explicitly says it. And it's entirely not relevant to the storyline. Doesn't tell you anything about the characters. There's no consequence to that conversation. It's just a subtle, probably unintentional conversation that the writers just went, oh yeah, you know, this is how to explain their first romantic experience, possibly because of their own personal experience, possibly because they think that the audience will relate to it. I don't know, but it certainly reinforces a particular behaviour, doesn't it? Yeah, question.
Do you know what gender writers are? And does that matter? Do you think it's related to the
ad? You know, when I was looking at the IMDb information about this, I did see the first names, and I can make certain inferences based on that as to gender, and I do believe that the majority of the people working in this production in senior roles are male. And yes, that probably has some influence in the kinds of norms that they expect are appropriate storytelling conventions. Yeah, sure, that probably has. And it's also based on a Japanese. So, you know, we're getting all kinds of cultural mix of influences there as well. I would hazard a guess that maybe that scene, the themes that are apparent in that scene are more relevant to the American adapters of the story than maybe the original Japanese. So here's a fun fact. In 1934, American film production adopted a code that suppressed representations of sex and violence in movies. Why did they do that? Because they know that it's going to influence the viewers. It's going to affect people. Yeah, that it's not socially condonable to represent sex and violence. And yet something like that scene is subtle enough to be able to slip through any, production codes, because it's not explicitly violent, it's not explicitly sexual. Sounds fun. So, those are some of the negative things, and I could probably give examples of harmful effects until the cows come home. And to some extent, I'd assume you're probably aware of many of those issues because they're talked about in popular culture quite often. I think we need to remember that media also can be used for social good. Yeah, it's not all harmful. There's some really positive forces that can happen. So there are indirect methods of encouraging social good, and largely that has focused on how to provide positive representations of marginalised groups to improve situations for those people who identify with those marginalised groups. I'd like to highlight something, though. So in the US, black children experience higher self-esteem when exposed to TV programs featuring black characters, because the prior research shows that there's a consequence of lower self-esteem when they see stereotypical prejudiced representations of characters that they would relate to. Problem. We know that individuals interpret the messages that are portrayed. They adapt them to their own social norms, their understandings of scripts and schemas, their own goals and values. And so the indirect methods don't necessarily always produce the desired interpretations for the audience, because they're selectively attending to certain messages and not others. Yeah, so these indirect messages, as an intentional way of promoting social good, don't always work, because there are some participants in this example who didn't evaluate the portrayals as negative for whatever reason, and therefore they don't get the benefit of the higher self-esteem. Yeah. So direct methods can be more effective at producing social good, particularly, as an example, there are other methods, but particularly I'd like to point out entertainment education, which is the intentional placement of educational content in entertainment messages. Sorry. And the research has shown that it is effective at supporting social change and pro-social behaviour. And part of the reason that entertainment messages are quite conducive to promoting these certain effects is a theory of transportation. So when people are entertained, they're enjoying the narrative that they're watching, they actually get transported into the world of that media narrative, and that makes them much more open and receptive to the messages that are being communicated. Now, that can be a positive or a negative thing. You know, if they're observing messages that can be harmful, they're much more open and receptive to those. But if the messages are pro-social, they can be quite useful. So entertainment reduces the barriers that somebody might have to make them more critical or more resistant to the messages that are being portrayed. So an example that I have for that, in 2005, two TV shows within a few months of each other, ER and Grey's Anatomy, featured storylines about the BRCA gene mutation, about breast cancer. And as a consequence of that, they raised awareness of the incidence of breast cancer and the necessity for people to go and get screened and tested. And you know, a lot of people were able to get screened and get treatment and had better outcomes because of watching it in a drama TV show. Yeah. In 2013, Angelina Jolie announced that she had been tested and that she decided to undergo a double mastectomy to prevent the development of the cancer that she had a genetic predisposition to do. And that in itself also increased people's awareness of the issue to the extent that the testing for the BRCA gene rose 64% in the 15 days after the media reported on her result and her surgery. 64% incidence of people going and getting screened. So it's not just drama or fictional narratives that cause these effects for people. It's also, you know, celebrities' real news stories that can promote positive social outcomes because people are more receptive to the messages. I mean, the celebrity influence is obviously a huge factor in influencing people's behaviour. So we know that entertainment education can be used to create favourable attitudes, to model certain behaviours, to teach skills and knowledge, provide behavioural cues that make people more likely to behave in a certain way in response to those cues, and then also simulate the consequences of behaviour so that people can learn vicariously by watching a consequence for a character and therefore learning, okay, well, I will do that or I won't do that because I've seen what happens to that character as a response. So here are just a bunch of current research that's been looking at entertainment education in a variety of contexts and essentially showing that it is effective at producing social change and raising awareness and attitude change. So that's all the background. And then my PhD research. So I said, you know, that's interesting. We're looking at media effects in terms of behaviours and people's emotions, people's perceptions, people's relationships. What about the person themselves? Yeah. How do we understand what effect media has on personality? Now, that's a very hard area to research because personality is complex and it develops over the course of a person's lifetime. So I was particularly interested in the part about narrative media, and I came across an explanation by a personality psychologist called Dad McAdams, who talked about narrative identity. And essentially his theory is that without being able to verify what exactly a person's personality is, you can explore their story about who they are, their life story, to get a sense of who they perceive themselves to be. And they understand themselves in three ways. First, as an actor, social actor, who has relationships with other people and who has qualities that can be understood by those people. You know, I'm extroverted, I'm ambitious, you know, this is an actor self-talking. They can understand themselves as an agent, a person who is motivated to achieve certain goals, who holds certain values. There are certain cultural influences in terms of that that provide a script for how a person, what kind of goals are appropriate to orient yourself towards achieving at certain life stages. Yeah, that's all part of the self as an agent. And there's also the self as an author, which is really the more self-reflective part that a person can reflect on their life and reflect on how they tell their story, and that can change over time. And McAdams said that that's the level where media can be most influential. It provides a menu of images, metaphors, plots, motifs, character representations from which we select all of what we've ever seen and incorporate that into an understanding of ourselves to tell this story. Yeah, we need some basis on which to generate these ideas and these images, and that the media provides us that because it's a world beyond our small social circle in our family unit or our immediate social environment. So that's the theoretical background. I wanted to extend on that. McAdams himself didn't, he claimed this in his theory, but he didn't necessarily do any research to actually explore how the media does this. So I wanted to get a little bit more of an understanding of that. So last year, I think it was last year, I spoke to 14 young Macquarie University students and conducted what's called a life story interview with them. And I also asked them about the media examples that they thought were influential in who they were as a person. And those 14 participants generated 99 media examples. that they thought were relevant to them. And I thought it was very interesting, just the basic demographics, the breakdown of those 99 media examples. So I just left it very open. I said any narrative media that you can think of. I thought it was interesting that 63% of what was influential for them was TV and film, 11% was books, and 11% was YouTube and social media, which I just entirely didn't count on, even coming up in the slightest. I also thought it was very interesting that over half of the examples that they generated were produced in the US or represented American people, and a smaller number of that were media products that had been produced in Australia. Ranged across genres, approximately 50-50 split between fiction and non-fiction, so there was no real trend there. But, you know, I did a little bit more digging to try and understand what's this influence with YouTube and social media. And the participants told me, you know, they liked getting on YouTube and watching people vlog about their daily lives. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll go and have a look at some of these things. Here's an example of one of these vloggers.
Hello everybody, today I wanted to do something a little bit different and something that I love hearing about, and that is ways that people like to de-stress or just kind of switch off and have a little bit of me time. You all know how much I love to encourage people to have downtime, me time, and to recharge their batteries, which is why I wanted to do a video on the ways that I choose to do that. So the different ways I choose to de-stress, or if I'm just having a particularly busy month, or I just find that life is getting a little bit too much, which I'm sure we all do from time to time.
So she goes on, I don't think you need to see the rest of the video. She gives various suggestions about how to de-stress. And, you know, well, that's nice that, you know, 1.8 million viewers have had a look at that video and have identified that, you know, they like her suggestions for how to de-stress. My slight concern about that is that she's just an amateur video maker, yeah? She's now kind of built her profession being an amateur video maker. I'm a registered psychologist with at least 6 years' training in giving health advice to clients. I have a responsibility and a code of ethics about what my clients do with that information. What responsibility does an amateur video maker have to what the client, or what the viewer does with the information that she suggests? And I don't have a problem particularly with what she says. It's the kind of things that psychologists might recommend for their clients, but is there any risk? Yeah, I guess is my question. So here's an example of a viewer comment to this video. It says, you know, I've been struggling with anxiety of depression and thank you for this video. That's fine, but what if that person isn't actually seeing anybody to help them with their anxiety and depression? What if they're getting that advice from an amateur video maker who just says, here's what I find helps me, that may not be the appropriate advice for this person? Yeah, and that's not an uncommon situation, that people are looking to these media figures as some authority on how to live a life. Like, that's what my research participants told me, you know, that they're interested in how other people deal with things and that they learn vicariously through them. It's risky. So in terms of the results from my research, as expected, most of my participants did say that the media did influence them. They could reflect on themselves as an actor, saying, you know, I model myself like these really strong female characters, like in Hunger Games, and I want to be strong like her. Yep. So thinking about their own traits. Their self as an agent saying, well, you know, I'm really interested in, I've completely forgotten her name. Anyway, a queer person that is well known in Australia and blogs about her particular career choices, and one of the participants gave that as an example of, I want to be a queer person like them. Yep, so inspiration for their own personal goals. The media encouraged reflexivity and development of ideologies, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, and helped people to think about national identity concerns, and I'll also talk a little bit about that. As Australians, I think we can conclude, at least within my own sample, and I'd have to test this more to generalise it, that Australians are heavily influenced by American media, which is hardly surprising when you consider how much American media is shown on our screens and in our cinemas. So, yeah, some people denied being influenced, but they were still able to talk to me about their favourite media and how it was important to them. So even if they are rejecting the idea at a conscious level, they're still explaining to me that it was influential for them. So here's two examples. Media oriented people to their salient identity concerns. Dylan is a transgender individual who liked the idea of the escapism in Harry Potter, the ability to use magic to become the self that he wanted to be. Yep, to leave behind his physical gendered reality and to be a boy and live however he chose with the help of magic. Alex identified as a Chinese Indonesian Australian and reflected that she didn't see a lot of people like her on the screen. She watched old Hollywood movies where all of the main female characters were white. And it wasn't until I kind of probed that explanation that she said, oh, well, yeah, actually, maybe that did set me up with... I don't really want to go play with that anyway. We'll just be in darkness for a little while. Yeah, she said, you know, maybe that is problematic. Maybe that gave me ideas of what beauty should be because I wasn't seeing people that looked like me. Now, I can't necessarily say that this has any direct association, but Alex also reported to me that she had an eating disorder when she was growing up. Yep. And we know that from research, especially coming out of South Korea, that when people are exposed to heavily Americanized media, their beauty ideals match the media that they are viewing, and that those who watched more American media in South Korea were more likely to endorse westernized beauty ideals than people who looked like South Koreans. That country at the time that research was conducted also had one of the highest rates of plastic surgery. So again, can you join the dots between those things? Yeah. So if you're not seeing people that look like you on the screen, your self-esteem is going to get affected and you are potentially going to take actions to try and make yourself look more like what you idealise as being the preferred way of being. I found it interesting that my participants also were quite interested in American politics. At the time that I conducted this research, we had just witnessed President Trump's election, so that was probably a salient theme for them. But I found it really interesting that they endorsed critical thinking about the political situation and the social issues that had developed out of the political discussions as part of that election. And that, you know, they're starting to say, and this is developmentally appropriate for young adults to be saying, well, I'm developing my own opinions. Yep. And I'm trying to learn not to discriminate and judge others. And, you know, I'm learning about social issues because of this discourse, and I'm having the willingness to understand that other people might think differently to me. You know, that's fantastic in terms of maturity and that kind of critical thinking about the media narratives, because they're not necessarily just jumping on board with, oh, well, you know, this group of people is portrayed as negative, and so I believe that too. Yeah, so it looks like these young adults are starting to look to the media and develop their own opinions and beliefs about that. Another theme that came up quite often in my own research was the representation of Muslim people, in particular around terrorist attacks. So a number of my participants recalled viewing the footage of the Sydney Lent Cafe siege, and they had different perspectives about those events or those kind of terrorist events. So the first one, Nicole was empathising with the fear aspect of the terrorism, which is quite possibly what these terrorist acts are intended to do, to create fear in the viewer to think, well, this could happen to me. Yeah, this is a scary place and that I could get hurt. Alicia identified as Muslim and was very upset at the representation of Muslims because she said it reflected her community. Yep, and she was concerned about how the general public would respond to her community in response to the way that this man had gone on television and done an act that she didn't think that the community would identify with. And Mary as well, Mary didn't identify as Muslim, but she was very concerned about the kind of conversations that were being had in the media in response to these terrorist attacks, the vilification of Muslim people, and
took it upon herself to be a kind of an advocate and to talk to other people about how those kinds of attitudes that were being portrayed in the media weren't appropriate. Yeah. So really different perspectives there, but really interesting that these young people are trying to work out what they see on the screen and how to fit that into their own value systems. So for one of my next studies, I'd really like to explore that aspect of media literacy, you know, that critical thinking about how media influences them, to try and help individuals create that barrier between the messages that are being communicated through through all forms of media, fiction and non-fiction, and how talking about their life story can help them kind of self-reflect and to think on that. So that's my hope for my next research. But I guess my question is, coming back to my own experience, you know, working in Biggest Loser, the day that photo was taken that I showed you in the beginning there, I remember being miserable. Yeah, I didn't enjoy my job. And it wasn't something that was meaningful or valuable for me. And I had to make a decision what would be meaningful for me. And so thinking about how to live a life in line with values can help people to make decisions that support their own values, support their own sense of purpose in their life. And I guess it's a question to think about, you know, whatever area somebody works in, whether it's media scholarship, media production, as a viewer, if you think about actually what's important to you and what's important to the society that you belong to, would you take on board more of your personal responsibility to be an individual within that society that helps to promote social good rather than social harm? There's a lot of conversation about diversity and inclusivity, which is fantastic. And you want to see that actually produce more social change. Yeah. So in thinking about that, the Oscars this year was quite an interesting discussion about Time's Up, about diversity, about inclusivity. And I quite liked, and they showed a video about trailblazers for diversity. And I just wanted to kind of draw your attention to what motivates people perhaps to do what's for the social good. So, sure, there's a lot of reasons why we know that doing, using the research that we know about media effects should be used for social good. The question is, what is each individual going to do in order to make that happen? And people have different motivations for that. So I guess my question is for you, if you could contribute in some way, in your own individual way, what would you be doing differently to contribute to socially responsible media? Thank you.
Oh, well, in that convenient lull, I might reconvene us then. Yeah, grab some food, everyone. I certainly have grabbed some more wine for myself. So you guys have the floor and then, you know, go for as long as you want and then open it up to questions whenever you guys are...
We haven't necessarily prepared anything.
No,
so.
Maybe I should start by introducing myself. I've talked to a few of you in just meeting here, but my name's Chanel. I am a colleague of Dania, also in the Department of Psychology, and I'm a PhD candidate here. We share a supervisor in Dr. Wayne Warburton. So I met Dania because, you know, we just bumped into each other as being part of the PhD process, and then we discovered that we have some really mutual interests in the area, partially facilitated by our supervisor, Dr. Wayne Warburton. So technically my area of research is aggression, but I have a very, very strong interest in media influences on aggression, and that is where my current research focus is. So I was our current supervisor, Wayne Warburton's research intern in my third year, where we were researching the impact of violent song lyrics on aggression. And then I carried that forward during my honours year. And then I shifted a little bit to looking at video games in my master's year. And now I'm still currently looking at video games as a risk factor for aggression. at the moment. So, as, you know, Dania brought up in her talk, that there is, you know, a whole bunch of research out there showing that media affects us, right? And one of the areas that she brought up, which is my area of interest, is violent media. And what I'm currently seeing in the field is, you know, a lot of a shift in terms of talking. How can we get messages about media across to the general public better? Okay, and that's something that I guess links back to Dania's question that she brought up to us, right? So if you could contribute to the production, dissemination, or reception of socially responsible media, what would you be doing differently? So the way that I thought about that was, how could I correct some of the misinformation about violent media research that's out there? Because there is a lot of that. Recently, what's come up is after the recent school shooting in the States was Donald Trump blaming video games for the school shooting, which has led to a lot of rhetoric in the media about how, no, this is not the case, and therefore violent media does nothing to influence aggression. We've got two completely extreme views, but no nuanced discussion happening. And that's a problem because the research is actually very nuanced. There is very little research showing that violent media links to violence. There are some good theoretical reasons for why that may be the case, but currently the data isn't quite there. What the research does show, though, is that when it comes to mild levels of aggression, the way that we can ethically manipulate in experiments, right? Because like the Bobo doll experiment that Dania brought up, right? We can't make people punch each other in the face, but what we can do is maybe get them to punch a doll. Or in some of my experiments, I get them to allocate hot sauce to somebody that they know doesn't like hot sauce. Or currently what I'm manipulating is a modified version of the cold presser task, where if any of you have been in, put your hand in some really cold water or potentially after some sport, taken an ice bath to relax the muscles, that's kind of painful, right? So I get my participants to put their hand in some cold water to get a sense of, ooh, this is unpleasant and potentially painful, and get them to rate how many seconds they would let someone else leave their hand in that water after some experimental manipulations, right? So what I've done recently is actually to answer, you know, Dania's question is Wayne and I, we co-authored a piece for The Conversation, getting out there trying to help people understand the distinguished the nuance in understanding what the difference A between aggression and violence is, which I won't go too much into because it's not the topic of this talk, but also in order to help help people understand what the nuanced research is and why we should take media research important in terms of how it affects us in terms of our aggressive behavior, even though it may not necessarily link to people picking up a gun and shooting people.
Which I think after Trump said that, a whole lot of researchers came out and said, actually, there's no good evidence. You know, X number of these school shooters actually have no interest in playing video games. So as a message, it was untrue.
Yes.
And certainly biased the public opinion towards the video game research even further than it might have already been. And
yep.
I guess what you're talking about, you know, that you've taken it upon yourself to be, you know, your individual responsibility is to share some of your scholarly knowledge with the general public through The Conversation, which is set up for this purpose, if you're not familiar with it, to get the general public to be more aware of what the research is. My observation is that there are huge gaps between what researchers know and what people in industry or what the general public know. And I think part of the challenge, perhaps, is how do we close that gap? Yeah, how do we get more of the scholars to communicate their research in ways that other people can use it and understand it.
And can understand. That's precisely the point, because, you know, science is complicated, right? Trying to talk to people about p-values, don't go there, right? So what you need to try to do is convey in a more kind of theoretical sense, you know, what we're talking about. And something that, you know, our supervisor talks about a lot, Wayne, is that he likes to talk about how media is a lot like chocolate, okay? Little bit is okay, right, if it's the bad kind of media, right? It's okay. It's probably not impacting you too much. But you have to have it in moderation, right? Too much chocolate, obesity, health problems. Similar things when it comes to your media consumption, right? Because a lot like food with media, you are what you eat. And so it's A, important to be critical, like Dania was bringing up in her talk, and B, it's important to moderate your use to make sure that you're not having too much of the bad stuff and trying to fill your diet with as much of the metaphorical fruit and vegetables as you can find that's out there.
Hmm. Which is a great message for consumers. Yeah, so consumers to regulate their own media diet. I have a colleague who's also a psychologist who's quite interested in the area of digital media use, especially by young people. So we know there's, you know, problems with addiction to certain technology. There's a whole host of reasons why that term addiction is problematic, but she talks about digital nutrition. Yeah, a little bit is okay. Banning phones or, you know, technology altogether is not necessarily going to work, because kids are pretty good at getting around their parents and getting access to it anyway. But if we can teach them how to regulate themselves, how to have a mindset that's about, you know, balance and nutrition and having a little mix of the good and the bad, hopefully that can mitigate some of those harmful effects and also keep them with the positives that can be had. So I think maybe the common theme across a number of our colleagues that are working in this area is not to be polarized about it, but to have that kind of middle ground of saying, yeah, there's some good, yeah, there's some bad. Let's acknowledge that and make sure that we get those messages across
as in as accessible a fashion as we can is I guess the key point, because something that, you know, we as, you know, scientists get lost a lot is getting caught up in the jargon. And, you know, when we talk to someone about how violent media links with aggression, you know, the thing that a layperson is going to think of, oh, it's picking up a gun and shoot people, whereas we're not necessarily, you know, operationalizing those variables in that exact same manner. So it's so important to begin with, you know, your definitions, right? Getting definitions clear is so important. And often what we see in the way that, you know, science is translated into, you know, accessible fashions for lay people, right, is that that's kind of forgotten, right? And that might be partially because, you know, journalists come from a different background to scientists, right? And so they're kind of reading the science with as much skills as they can and trying to translate that as best they can. But that currently hasn't been working. So I kind of really enjoy that there are outlets like The Conversation that allow scientists like us to be like, oh, okay, let's turn this into something that lay people can understand and actually know, really understand what we mean when we talk about something like aggression, or something like something that came up in the discussion during the preamble about what a narrative means, even. Because some people think, oh, narrative means fiction. And when Dania talks about it in her research, no, that also applies to non-fiction texts as well, because it's just about the story that comes across.
Mm. Or the converse. Some of my participants, whenever I said media, even though I gave them a definition that was fairly broad and inclusive, whenever I said, how do you think media has affected you, they were like, I don't think news affects me that much. I'm like, we don't just mean news when we talk about media, you know, like, think a little broader than that, you know, what are the other things? So, yeah, people have kind of associations and ideas that they latch onto about certain terms or words, and that might prevent them from necessarily understanding all of the complexity around certain issues or explanations for things. And, I mean, the reality is that there is a lot of different kinds of media and they have a lot of different kinds of effects, and it's hard when you talk about such a topic as this that's very general, because there are subtle differences, but also similarities across, you know, all the forms of all the mediums, all the different types of stories, all the different ways that people access those stories. It's far broader than sometimes we communicate when we scientist-type people talk about it.
And that even, you know, ties in like a meta level to when you watch a movie or a TV show. Sometimes the message that the author is trying to convey is not the one that you internalize, which is what Dania brought up there, right? So it's a problem, I guess, that fundamentally comes down to communication, because media is a form of communication, right? When I talk to artists, filmmakers, musicians about why they create their chosen medium, they talk about how they're trying to get a message across and they want to affect people. Right. And they're trying to do that in as clear a way as they can. But of course, when someone comes across, you know, this TV show or this movie and they've never met the author at all ever in their life, they're going to have their own kind of background biases that come along. Right. And then they're going to take their own interpretation and kind of think that, oh, that's what the author meant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's really interesting when we're talking about media effects, how much of it is also intended and unintended. And when it comes to having, you know, responsibilities on the producer's part, that becomes a bit difficult to manage, which is why I think a strength of what your research is that Dania brought up, you know, this kind of two-pronged approach where there's some responsibility on the producer's end, but there's also responsibility on the viewer's end, where we need to encourage some sort of media literacy going on, whilst also encourage, you know, the producers of media to be responsible in what they're putting forward.
Mm. And to be aware of the research and to actively decide to make use of that information in the decisions that they make. So, you know, as with the example from Unreal that I showed, they might be aware of the, you know, media violence literature, but they don't care because the product sells. And I guess that's the problem with media products, in that they're economic products. They're meant to make money. They're meant to sell. Even when a independent media producer creates their own story and they want to get a message across and they want the audience to receive that, they want the audience to like it. They want it to be successful. Yeah, so they're making decisions about what they're showing on the basis of what they expect the audience is going to like. And it's easy to assume what the audience liked because something else over here did it this way and that was successful, so I'll do it like that. Yeah, but that just kind of encourages this closed loop, you know, default to the stereotypes, default to the, you know, representations that are well established, and mm-hmm. it's risky to then do something different.
Mm. Yeah.
I think what's happening at the moment is that, like you found, the influence and the rise of Facebook and YouTube is actually shifting the narrative by people taking control of it themselves. And as mm-hmm. that changes, it changes the mainstream. That's true. You see perspectives shifting reasonably quickly at the moment, and it's trending away from this control of the big organisations and the dictatorship of this is how things are, to letting people have their own voice and tell it in their own way. Mm-hmm. And it's adjusting the way I think things are being shown mm-hmm. a lot. And it has shifted the world. I mean, it's an unintended thing, but Facebook triggered the Arab Spring because mm-hmm. people could communicate to themselves with themselves outside of the organisations that suppressed them from communicating. And in that way, it's having the biggest effect since the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. This technology revolution is changing the world very quickly, mm-hmm. and not necessarily the results of it can be terrible because it can lead to a lot of people becoming refugees and, you know, all of those things. But it's change, it's dynamic change, and it's happened fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of this social, the internet.
Mm.
But it's changing the agendas. I'd say Australian television, mainstream television, is changing year on year because of the rise of these types of things that you showed, like vloggers at home doing their little blurbs and being more natural, and people now want that kind of thing in mainstream television.
It seems more authentic than the constructed narratives. But you also get the same dialectic, perhaps, between amateur media makers using their, you know, their production skills for social good, you know, to promote political change or something like that, or, you know, people getting on, you know, and doing videos about how to lose weight to maintain your anorexic lifestyle. You know, that there's a balance. It is, and nobody's going to regulate that.
Speaking about what they want to speak about, now they can do it on the internet ad nauseum. If you don't want to watch it, you don't have to watch it.
And yet we've also got regulation coming in and saying, well, Facebook and Twitter and et cetera have a responsibility to take down content that's not socially appropriate. So there is still censorship. You know, we don't have free speech because social media now has to be regulated because we're aware of that potential risk. So. And fake news.
And fake news.
Yeah.
I guess maybe it might be a good idea to try to gauge, you know, from the audience, you know, any kind of questions that you might have for Dania or myself, or even if, you know, you thought about Dania's leave-off question from her presentation, if you guys maybe thought up any kind of answers that you might have.
I wonder if I could play devil's advocate for a minute.
Yeah.
I'll read that question. Where does that leave things like avant-garde filmmaking? I mean, why should any media be socially responsible? And especially outside of kind of the popular mainstream media that seem to be just appeal to all. Why, you know, I guess I already asked my question, why should media be socially responsible, especially if it's not gauged at kind of widespread dissemination, like
Most of
why should it? I mean, that's the same question that Quinn and Rachel had a conversation in Unreal, you know, as a media producer, do I care whether it affects anybody or not? I just want to make the story that I want to make. Is that selfish? Maybe, you know, other people might say so, but, you know, I come back to, I guess I tend to take a fairly broad view and come back to that idea about values. You know, if somebody's making something and say, well, I'm doing this for a reason and I'm happy about that and other people like it, well, that's one motivation. Yeah, if you're an avant-garde filmmaker and people are positively receiving your work and you're getting paid to do more of it, that's a great motivator to keep doing it. But is knowing the research, and I guess my main point is, if scholars can communicate their research to producers and to audiences, is knowing about the media effects put a responsibility back to the individual to question about what's important to them? Yeah. And if their actions are, well, I want to make this because it makes me money or because it's my story to tell, I don't care about whether it affects anybody else, they have to live with that. Yeah, that's their choice and their responsibility. I guess my question is, if we generally as a society agree that we collectively have a responsibility to the messages that get communicated, what we see on the screen is just a reflection of our society to some extent. We project the anxieties and the experiences that we as individuals have that we think other people might be able to relate to. And so we are in some way taking on a responsibility to represent the world the way that it is. Yeah. And it's up to the individual, I guess, to choose about how genuine they are about doing that and about their motivations for doing that. And ultimately, as society's values shift, as we said, to become more demanding of inclusivity and more demanding of diversity and for people to take responsibility for those potential effects, people maybe have to choose to take that individual responsibility because there's the pressure, the social pressure, to do so. Does that answer that question?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is, talking about a question, I think we know from the media that negative stories in the newspaper are more memorable than positive stories. The people are more attracted. If someone gets run over by a car, everybody will walk over and look at it, you know, because we're completely fascinated by this. And it's just something that the brain does. As humans, we're very interested in death and destruction, and when people are having a fight, we'll all run over and watch it, you know, because we're interested in it.
That's and if we weren't interested in an emotional response,
we wouldn't watch it. The brain becomes more fixated on a negative thing than it does on a positive thing. So when television has negative things like shoot-'em-ups and, you know, conflict and tension and drama, people like it. They get dragged in. And the other thing they like is gossiping about relationships. So they watch Maps, then they gossip. It's like living in a village and everybody gossiping about, did you see that couple? Oh, I think they're going to break up. Well, it's just that. It's just instead of gossiping about the village, we watch it on TV and then we go to work the next day and we gossip about them. We love it. Fascinating. So that's why they do it. That's why the show's great, because it plays into one of our innate things that we really enjoy.
Yep. I guess part of the overall question there is, why do we love it? And is it we love it because we're fed this and we're continually fed an essence of gossip? And it could possibly harken back to those, you know, ancestral ties where we're all around a little village and everybody, and there's an interconnected, and it possibly it is the fact that what it gives you is it gives you something to talk to another person about. It gives you a connection to another person because there's shared information.
Is it also then,
as I think Daniel has been saying, a slightly self-perpetuating cycle where these things are popular and so they are then made more of, so they are then consumed more of, so then they're made popular, so they're then...
It's an ever-increasing cycle
because if you break out of that... it's maybe it doesn't rate as well. You know, we're talking about ratings, we're talking about ultimately economics. It doesn't rate as well, and so people go, oh, no, that's not rating. Quick, go back to the, you know, go back to the people love Crazy Cat Show.
Or the big tentpole blockbusters.
Yeah.
You know, the movie studios aren't willing to take too many risks because they know this is what's going to bring in the revenue, so we'll make the shoot-'em-up film that's going to appeal to young males.
If I can just add to that, something that's very well documented in psychology is something called the familiarity effect. We like what's familiar. And this is very basic to the point where there was one study that just kind of very quickly flashed up some character symbols from, I believe it was Japanese kanji. I'm not quite sure, but it was one. But it was one of the Japanese written languages. They just flashed them up, and then later they presented you some images of some kanji, and some of those were those that were flashed up, and some of those were not. And people said that they liked the aesthetic appeal of the kanji that were flashed up before them, as opposed to the ones that were kind of new and novel to them. So is it because they just liked those kanji, or is it because that they were just familiar and exposed to those previously? Mm. Right. So the question is it that you're liking it because it's self-perpetuated, or is it that you actually like it? And that's something that's very hard to disentangle.
Mm.
And what we would say from my area is that most people don't like seeing someone in pain, really don't. And what we see in news stories, right, where if I can take my country of heritage, Lebanon, right, where the news media that we're showing there, right, very war-torn country, they will take a whole lot of time to focus on the weeping family members, okay? When you contrast that to what's in the West, it's not, right? It's really brought up on the death and destruction and the anger that people feel. If people are exposed to the kind of empathy and the sadness that people are feeling as a response to this, people are like, oh, I don't like that, right? So the further, you know, you kind of removed away from the kind of original visceral feeling, which most, you know, children, right, when they see something, you know, dead or dying, they get upset and they're kind of, they get, you know, scared of it. The more you move yourself away from that kind of biological visceral response, the more likely you're then going to go, oh, I just like it. When kind of we're predisposed to not like these things, biologically speaking.
And then there's the whole desensitization aspect of repeated viewings that reduces the physiological arousal that happens from those initial distresses.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because we get used to things. So, you know, we get very used to violent movies, right? So Tarantino movies are kind of the classic examples that are kind of brought up. People are very used to having that violent imagery if you watch a lot of that.
Mm.
People for the very first time going in to watch a Tarantino movie, shock, horror, this is awful, get it away from me, right? So you get two very different responses depending on how desensitized you are to these types of
And so that's about context. It's also true with structures. So we're used to Aristotelian narrative structures that have a beginning, middle, and an end. People also get upset when they see a narrative that doesn't conform to that story structure. Yeah, so your avant-garde films tend to disrupt that structure. And it's a less popular way of telling stories. You know, the Hollywood structure is really based on this beginning, middle, and an end because people are familiar with it. It's predictable. It's more enjoyable because they can kind of see, they can go along and go, I know what's going to happen next. And yes, he's the hero and he defeats the bad guy and he gets the woman in the end. And yeah, I like that. Yeah, that redemptive narrative is reassuring to people. And it has a social function. You know, it tells us that in society, good triumphs over evil and, you know, that the predictable story gets resolved. That, you know, I think these stories, in part, we're tapping into these kind of basic social needs to understand what the social world is going to be like. And our stories give us that sort of sense of satisfaction and reassurance, which makes the popular ones more.
I've always imagined that the modern movie theatre sitting in the dark and watching flickering pictures goes back to sort of people sitting in caves and drawing paintings and having candlelight. And they sit around and tell stories. But, I mean, you don't tell the story about the day we went to hunt the woolly mammoth and we all died. You tell the day about, I went to hunt the woolly mammoth, we got the woolly mammoth, and we brought it back and we had a feast. Yay! And he's a hero because he shot the most arrows, you know. Yeah. That's the story we like to tell.
Because
we
it's meant to be educational,
because
right?
It's supposed to somebody came home.
Teach the people watching it, this is what you do to succeed.
But it's a hero story. We like the hero story because we fought a war, we fought off the barbarians, we won. Let's tell that story forever.
Because we identify with the hero. We want to be the hero, and it teaches us how to be a hero in our
daily lives. And it's not necessarily that the hero has to be the person who's gone and fought a war.
Mm.
The hero can be someone like Martin Luther King, who was an extreme pacifist, right? So we like hero stories, but that doesn't necessarily mean we like the kind of guts and gore that might come along with some of them.
Action hero
kind of stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm also just aware of time. That it's 7:10 and people probably have families to...
Yeah, if there were any kind of last questions or comments...
just going to sort of add, what if audiences like things that are familiar, and presumably media producers know that, to what extent is it in their interest to do things differently, to be more socially responsible? Why change if people like what is familiar to them?
Well, because you can make anything familiar. Right. And so people who come in with the value that, no, representing minorities is important, and they really push to make something like a minority story, and then, you know, they can show that that gets traction, and then someone else can make a minority story. And then slowly but surely, that's going to build the familiarity that's big enough to make, oh, every movie out there should be full of minorities, right? So the recent kind of Netflix movie that came out, Annihilation, have we all heard of that, right? It's... there are some very subtle things about that movie that I appreciate. So there's, to not spoil anything, but, there is one shot of, one of the female leads where she's a biologist teaching her students, and they deliberately take the time to, you know, pan over the students, and front and center is a scarfed Islamic woman, right? What other movie have you ever seen, you know, kind of front and center that a kind of neutral, almost, you know, positive, oh, look, here's an intelligent Islamic woman coming to study biology and potentially become a doctor.
In science, no less.
Yeah, in science, no less, right? So, and it's because of people, you know, wanting to push for these things. And then when you can make, like, you know, a big blockbuster that's getting a lot of people coming and viewing, then you can build that new familiarity where it's okay to show.
Black Panther's the
one. The big thing about Black Panther, which is just broke, I mean, lots of records and stuff, but most recently, it actually just topped the box office again this week.
Mm-hmm.
And the new Tomb Raider film has come out, and Black Panther actually beat it. Mm-hmm. So it's one of only six films in like the last 20 years that have consecutive, apart from Avatar.
Yeah.
Avatar is the only other film in the last 20 years.
And
five consecutive weeks at the top of the American US box office.
Mm-hmm.
Black Panther's done. Mm-hmm. So, regardless of what you think of the film, because it's interesting, there's a lot of people like, oh, it's kind of dull, it's kind of this. The number of comments of people that don't like the film are quite often not, well, for want of a better word,
racist.
Privileged white. But that's a film that's done that, and also because it was directed by the guy that did Creed, which was, you know, the Rocky film. I like films, and you probably know this one. But that's had a massive effect as well, in the same way that, you know, we saw a lot of female heroines coming out after the Hunger Games. And those people were like, oh, we need those kind of female-led heroine films.
Mm.
I mean, that's what Hollywood does. They jump on bandwagons.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is one stage where it's actually a bandwagon that could really advance social.
Yeah, and certainly the Oscars, that clip that I showed at the end there, of the montage that was shown at the Oscars, talking about how, you know, the Hollywood's pushing towards, you know, this greater diversity, both with women and people of colour and other minority groups. It is kind of the buzz topic of this year because of various reasons. So it will be interesting to see whether, you know, the representation of the films that were nominated for those awards, and whether all of the discussion around Me Too and Time's Up and the need to be more diverse in the screens to have, you know, positive...
Yep.
Just consequential portrayals of Muslim people. It's going to inclusion.
Inclusion,
yeah. Yes. Precisely. And again, just saying that is saying each of you actors, you have a responsibility, yeah, to use your piece of influence to make sure that you are advocating on behalf of these other people. Yeah. So we're having this conversation around saying, well, each person individually needs to take responsibility to make this happen. Because as a collective, it can only occur when individuals take the responsibility.
I think it's interesting that in Australia, not very many Australian films make profit, but several that I can think of that really did were Safars, which is an Indigenous story, and Strictly Ballroom, which was actually a migrant story.
Yeah.
So, which was another Indian-based story.
Mm.
So it's not that there's not a willingness to accept stories about diversity. It's just got to be a good story.
It's got to be a good story.
I think
and it's got to show.
That's the crux there. We're talking about Australian films that actually have good stories for change.
Yeah. And that means you can't just sort of do token representation. Yeah? You can't say, oh, I'm going to represent this ethnic group and let that be enough. Like, you actually have to build a good justification for it into the narrative so that people believe it, you know, that they get on board, that it's a good story, that it's engaging, that it's entertainment.
Mm.
Yeah? Because then it works.
Yeah, I guess...
we could
should
keep
probably,
talking forever,
yeah, we could talk
we?
Forever, but perhaps we should wrap it up there.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.